come to our attention that a mysterious force is loose somewhere in outer space.
Welcome to Talk Tank.
Hi, you've reached the Talk Tank, the official podcast of the LSC Entrepreneur Society, where we delve into the minds of those who think, live, and breathe outside the box. My name is Esther, and I'll be your host for today. Today's episode is part of our Artistpreneur series, where we steer clear of conventions and turn to the creative-hearted. We tune into the process behind the writers, the performers, and the visual storytellers. Do they confront us with reality or allow us to escape from it? Today's guest is Penny Martin, editor-in-chief of The Gentlewoman, a biannual women's magazine with style, character, and purpose. We're recording this interview between Mykonos, Amsterdam, and Fife, Scotland, where Penny lived for part of her childhood and has moved back to after many years in London. Penny grew up in a chaotic and colorful family home surrounded by pets, music, and art. She started her career path in academia with a background in art history and museum studies, but she soon chose the world of curating, or rather, it chose her. Since then, Penny has worked with well-known individuals in the fashion industry and curated online for Show Studio. In 2009, she was approached to co-create The Gentlewoman, which, fast forward, has just printed its 23rd issue with Scarlett Johansson on the cover. Penny, I'll leave explaining the magazine to you. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Can you give our listeners a brief introduction of The Gentlewoman? Who should be picking up this magazine in a bookstore?
Sure. It's a, as you said, a biannual women's title that we say is created for readers, which you might think all magazines are, but a great deal of attention is given to its journalism as well as its photography. I think that's the kind of uncommon mix. Often you find that independent publications in the fashion industry are one or the other. And it is Dutch owned. It started in Amsterdam. We are the little sister title of a bigger, older publication called Fantastic Man. And it was really our brief to come up with what the female equivalent of that title would be, which had a very uncommon and sort of strong personality, combination of long form personality centered journalism and candid photography. So with that kind of brief, we have developed over the years quite a particular character, I think. And we are an organization that is unusually involved with its readers. So we also have a club where we socialize with and involve our readers in international events that we've been very lucky to be able to develop. So I think that started to sort of cross-pollinate, and the publication is a reflection of the people that read it as much as the people that make it.
And can you tell me a bit about the title, Gentlewoman?
Sure. Well, that really came out of the challenge that it was to think of a title that was as good as Fantastic Man, which did a lot, not just in terms of selling the publication to its readers, but also attracting people to be in it. Because when you're starting off as an independent magazine that's produced twice a year, you know, a lot of the editorial team's job and time is spent trying to attract people to be interviewed for these long form, very in-depth, and hence quite time intensive pieces. So, you know, if you ring up and say, hey, we'd like you to be in Fantastic Man, I mean, who's going to say no? And a lot of people, of course, thought that our female version should be titled Fantastic Woman. But I think Gert Jonkers and Jop van Bennekom, who owned the company and started Fantastic Man, and I agreed that really we shouldn't pick a title that made it seem like a kind of rollout, corporate extension of the male title, and that really wouldn't be correct in terms of the message it would be giving out to its female readers, that they were somehow the kind of spare rib and not a sort of entity in themselves. So I had previously worked in the Fawcett Library, which then became the Women's Library, which is the oldest collection of women's history in the world, which is actually now part of the LSE's library holdings. But I was aware of the many women's periodicals that had been produced since the 18th century, and in fact was able to kind of corral a bunch of titles of current and defunct women's publications, just to discuss for sort of starters when we were sitting trying to work out what this thing should be during a meeting when I went over to Amsterdam to say, hey, if we're going to do this, what would it be like? And I ran loads of titles by them. And among them was The Gentlewoman, which had been 19th century and then into the 1930s, a publication that was kind of, I think it was called The Gentlewoman and Home, and it was an American magazine, is obviously now out of print for a long time. And we didn't say too much about that. At one point, we're thinking about making it Wonderful. Is it Wonderful Woman that's the double B-side on the 12-inch of This Charming Man by the Smiths? I think at one point I wanted it to be that. And anyway, it was a long conversation. And I then took another job. I became the Rootstein Hopkins Chair of Fashion Imagery at London College of Fashion, University of the Arts. The longest job title I think I've ever held. And in the meantime, I think they had settled on The Gentlewoman of my original choices. So the title I suggested, but among a bunch of others, and then I think they refined it, and the job was already underway. So they were creating a kind of pilot, I suppose, inside the 10th issue of Fantastic Man, the one with Ewan McGregor on the cover. And there was this little insert of two or three stories and a kind of proto cover called The Gentlewoman. So I was just scrabbling to finish everything so that I could start, because, you know, once they'd said they were doing it, I obviously had to ask Jop, who was then living in London, Gert was still in Amsterdam, to lunch and say, hey, you still doing this thing? And he was like, yeah. I said, oh, you still looking for someone to do it? And he still had his fork in his mouth. I can remember we were both eating crab. And he was like, yeah. And it was like, honestly, I keep saying it's like the rapture. I was like, great. And of course, I had no idea what I was doing. I'd never worked on a magazine before. But from then, the course was set. And that must have been about this time of year, spring 2009. And then I was at Fashion Week with Jop in September, well, in Milan with Gert, and then in Paris with Jop. That's September, October 2009. And we started, and we had however many months that left to launch the thing in start of March 2010. So an extremely short development time. But you might say, the three of us have been working on our whole lives, plus the other people that then got involved, like Veronica Ditting, then its art director, now its creative director, and Jonathan Kay, its fashion director. And those constituents still remain in place, although Gert and Jop no longer work directly on The Gentlewoman, but it's me and Veronica and Jonathan still.
It sounds an exciting moment, happiness over a crab lunch.
it always involves food and dancing, whatever, and quite a lot of drink generally. Good. Any sort of a significant moment in The Gentlewoman's history.
I like that. So it sounds like quite the process, starting The Gentlewoman with you and Jop van Bennekom and Gert Jonkers. Were you able to formulate the magazine's character from the onset, or was it quite an intense back and forth, or was it clear from the start what its purpose would be?
That's a very good question. How do you do that? Well, they had been working together, don't forget, by that time for 10 years. And they were Dutch. So I didn't have the language, literally didn't have the language. And they had, if you've worked very intensely in a studio with somebody, you start to barely speak. One of you receives a phone call with an offer or something like that, and the other one can hear in between the lines of what's being said, what's going on, and things happen sort of telepathically in facial expressions and things like that. So actually there was a technique that I needed to create in order to extricate that information from them verbally, because they'd stopped conversing. So much happened, the process had been created and the conversations had been had years ago. So I was always having to say, what was that? What does that mean? Tell me the story of this. When you say that, what exactly do you mean? Which is the quote that they always joke that I'm always saying, Penny, she needs to be understood. and then you know, you, I was, what age was I? Was I something like 35 or 36? And Veronica is 7 or 8 years younger than me. They're a few years older than me. We'd all had careers before this thing happened. And a lot of us, you know, we were all magazine fanatics. So there was a great deal of information that we all shared. You know, we knew the history of magazines and fashion communications for a start. But there's a sort of kabuki sort of dance where you're showing your references, you know, and you don't actually necessarily have them printed out, though Veronica likes to print out a lot of things. But you're saying, so do you mean like Twen? Oh, not like Twen. So do you mean like, you know, you're using references to evoke an aesthetic and decide whether you do or you don't like things. And, you know, you will know that Dutch people, from what I understand, are much more sort of, not defined, but they're much more motivated by what they hate than what they like, is it seems to me. So often it was about creating what was terrible and then, you know, deciding from there. But it wasn't styling, that's the thing. What you know, we were dealing with Dutch and graphic and German graphic designers, and they don't just come up with a style and sort of doodle it all over everything. It's about creating a system from scratch. It's quite modernist in its way, in that it's about a kind of ideology and a tool and a technique and a flourish last. You know, you're building, you know, when your assets come into the magazine, and we don't use a grid system. Do you know what I mean by that?
Not really.
Many, especially weekly and monthly magazines have a kind of redesign once every few years. And then there's a bunch of boxes and they get filled. You know, yes, they get massaged and moved around, but there's ultimately a core structure that kind of creates an impetus for the commissioning of material. Whereas you might say there's a kind of a recipe for what might be in our magazine loosely, but the way that our designers work is that everything gets commissioned and then we start from scratch every production, which most magazines would seem an enormous squandering of time and resources. But that's what gives it its particular kind of graphic energy. So there's a sort of, there's a reason and a message and a kind of mission in the way that that material is organized when you work with German and Dutch graphic designers. So a lot of it was about deciding on what the best tools were to express what we thought about women's media and what it should be communicating. So it wasn't just really about kind of coming up with a talent list and starting commissioning and kind of looking at other consumer titles and sort of borrowing the vernacular of the one that we thought was closest to us. It was far more sort of philosophical and intense and sort of industrial, I think would be the word, than that. So it was a very exposing experience because they had all made magazines. Veronica had worked with them on the first few issues of Fantastic Man. And in fact, she'd worked on some of the original publication that our company made, But Magazine. So they all knew that system and I was the least experienced. And yet I was the editor. So it was very vulnerable and exposing. Funnily enough, a couple of weeks ago, I was just WhatsApping Gert and Jop, reminding them a song had come on the radio, and it was a song we played a lot in the studio at the time when that was happening. And I was like, oh my God, I just heard that song. And it just gave me a shiver of the production of Number One. And Jop got back going, oh my God, that song, when I hear it, it also, you know, we were very, you know, they can't have thought they made a good decision. You know, they didn't know what was going to come out of me. And all they had was like 3 months of this girl asking them loads of questions and looking terrified. And working in, you know, enormously long hours, but nobody knew whether this publication would come out all right. And, you know, I think, you know, when you look at Number One, I think there's 120 pages. So that's kind of like a third to a half, between a third and a half of what we produce now. It's very naive in a really sort of charming way. But, you know, it must have been strange for them because they're already in the groove of producing two magazines in Fantastic Man. At that point, they were still printing But, which was like, I think was like 3 or so issues per year. Plus they were making Cost magazines. So they had a very sophisticated system going and they had to let this thing grow, knowing that it wasn't going to be quite as polished as what they were able to produce because they were having to put a lot of store by me as an editor. So it was a kind of amazing thing. I'd worked for very accomplished, iconic people in the industry before. I'd worked, you know, in a sandwich between the photographer Nick Knight and the art director Peter Saville for 7 years at Show Studio, and had been very much in the kind of curator apologist kind of role, the kind of Peggy Olson, the younger person, kind of being sort of encouraged, but also directed by much older men. And of course, in accepting the role, I knew, or that I didn't want to go back to that dynamic, and yet I was much less experienced. So I think it says a lot about them, Gert and Jop, that they didn't want to take credit for mine and Veronica's work. They let us stand in front of what they were doing, and they didn't have to. And many people in the industry, almost no people in the industry, would do that. You know, you look at television programs about other magazines that are being created, big magazines, and you know, there's always the kind of scene where the editor has to go up to the top floor and run it by the commercial director and the publisher, like they're kind of showing their homework to their daddy. That is not what this was like, and I couldn't have known that, and I won't ever forget that. That is a uncommon piece of freedom, and not just a compliment, it's really special that they didn't, you know, slap from the makers of Fantastic Man all the way through my career at the magazine, and just about every other publisher would have done that.
Yeah. I can imagine it sounds like a very cool process, and perhaps because you had kind of created this style that could be applied to all the content you're having, that they had this sort of faith in you and Veronica, maybe, to...
You could only say that in hindsight. I mean, I think they probably were relieved that the first one worked. The second one had amazing moments, but was kind of very much a second issue, which has always got a bit of a kind of correction wobble. I think it was at the point of the third issue where we were starting to get extremely ambitious and create kind of meta layers. It had a little mini magazine inside the magazine, this kind of little sort of... what would you call it, a kind of directory in it. And I think they were, you know, were kind of concerned that we weren't kind of going to go into overdrive, that we're going to let it be simple. But, you know, I'm listening to myself whilst I'm speaking here and imagining them listening to me saying this. And I also know that it wouldn't have occurred for them to behave like that. I don't know whether that's because they're Dutch and extremely egalitarian, or it was because they were gay men and it was a different culture. I don't know. I mean, they are really... politically interesting people, and you know, they would say they're not always easy to work with. They're not, but there was nothing unclear. It wasn't, you know, very British in that way that people will smile and they'll nod, but they don't necessarily agree or approve. It was very great, good to be free of that, and if anything, it was kind of a steep learning curve to learn how to work with people that were so direct that there was nothing left to sort of, no punches pulled. It was, you know, they would look at a piece of copy and say, well, that's terrible. You know, a British person wouldn't do that. They'd say, well, let's leave that for now and consider some, you know, something else or something. But then, considering how short a time we had to produce this thing, we needed to be able to travel across the surface really fast. And that required a kind of, so like that, no, not like that, because that's terrible. You know, we just needed a shorthand, and it's never really been much more verbose than that since.
Yeah, and as a Dutch person, I can definitely say that I recognize the directness of the process. We know that you're not supposed to have favorite children, but you're speaking of the second and third issue, and well, there's been 23 issues now. Is there one that comes to mind when I ask you to name your favorite, or is there a specific interview or element that really stuck with you?
They, of course, generate affection for different reasons. You know, there's the one that you felt that the editorial formula developed better, or there's the one that was the big celebrity endorsement that did something for the company, or there's the one where you have a personal story attached, etc. So I certainly could pick out ones for more specific reasons. I often cite the Angela Lansbury issue number 6 as important to me, just because it was the one that took on a life of its own. My dad died whilst we were making it, and we had to dismantle our incredibly intense production structure. We go into production for a month, and that's when the design and the editorial teams finally come together in the same space and kind of wrestle it out until it's made. Because, you know, I think in a lot of other publications, as I understand it, they're quite separate. You know, the editorial people will finish their copy and turn it in, and maybe subs will kind of refine it according to the designer's wishes in terms of kind of length and widows and things like that. But I have journalist friends that don't see their copy once that they've submitted it to design until the thing is on the newsstands. Whereas for us, that's just the start. Because in independent publishing, you're much more involved in the making of it and every single detail, because you're a smaller team. You know, if you've gone through an independent title, you probably know more about how to make a magazine in every bit of every stage than probably somebody that has a much more in-depth experience of, you know, working in features on a newspaper or something like that, where they would have no idea about the absolute nightmare that is going to the printers with the issue, etc. So yeah, there's that. I must say I'm very happy with the one we've just made, 23, just because we've now spent a year working out how to make it differently. Obviously, you know, the sort of preconceptions we had about having to be in the same space together, and of course we couldn't be, things like we thought we needed certain kinds of access, and actually we've worked out different ways, etc. So, you know, that was a shakier proposition, making issue 22, the one with Janelle Monae on it. And once we had that down, we were then able to kind of take the editorial structures in a different direction. So I think we've made a very sort of angular, slightly more punk, a little bit less sort of ladyish issue. It's got a kind of very, yeah, sharp energy that I feel is very timely. This isn't a kind of bourgeois moment. So I think in trying to find different ways to think about consumption, it was important that that was expressed timely, in a timely way. So I think that's great. But then, you know, just for sheer pleasure, I love a lot of the oral histories that we've done. That's those interviews where you have multiple interviewees that are interviewed around one core subject. So like in Vanity Fair, you might get, you know, when Mad Men were finishing, you might get the oral history, a reunion of the cast, and they're all asked to remember one precise moment. So we've done those about the launch of a fragrance or a very particular fashion show or the last episode of Cagney and Lacey. So they're kind of a bit of a Trojan horse for a kind of women's subject in the center of it, but then they're kind of multiple interviewees. So it's not an in-person interview, and they're sort of assembled and edited and condensed out of many conversations into one, as if the cast were all in the same room. And I think they're very different. They create an interesting counterpoint and energy when next to, you know, 3,000 words on Martha Stewart or something like that. You know, you get a very different kind of tone and pace. And our senior editor, Richard Amani, is a genius at doing those. They're fantastic. What else do I really like? It was good when we did Pamela Anderson, I think. Not because, I mean, it's a great story and fun pictures. It wasn't so much that it was the most polished profile necessarily that we'd done, but I think it was a moment where we chose to focus on somebody that perhaps wouldn't have been part of the list of typical gentlewomen when we first started the magazine. So I think that's in something like it's probably in issue 9 or something like that. And I think that's when we thought, okay, let's let sexy in a bit. We don't want to sexualize women. We don't want to be responsible for objectifying women. But we felt that there was a lack of a kind of lighter, more sensual aspect. We'd obviously set out our stall as very specific kind of imagery of clothing, etc., and it had been completely the opposite of the type of celebrity-centered weekly magazine fodder that you'd have seen on newsstands at the time when we first launched in 2010. So after an absence of that, it almost felt like there was a kind of void a little bit around that, and it was interesting to set ourselves the brief of letting that back in once we already had a very strict formula, recognizable and expected formula in that black and white photography and the kind of intelligent woman, and the kind of way she would dress and wouldn't dress felt very defined already. So it was fun to kind of break that up and smash it up a bit and have surprises in there. But you couldn't have done that from the start, otherwise it just wouldn't have been a particularly precise or easy to understand proposition had we started with that.
Yeah, I can imagine. You need to set the tone first, and then from there you start to develop your...
Yeah, a launch issue needs to be extreme one way or another. Otherwise you don't understand what the difference is between all the many other fashion biannuals, etc., that are out there. I mean, there are going to be fewer of those, aren't there? But at the time when we launched, it was a boom time, especially funded by the sort of zenith of weekly magazines. You know, those, you know, companies like Bauer and EMAP were producing things like Grazia, etc., and there was a lot of money sloshing around.
Yeah, and I like what you said earlier about the oral histories, the way that you revolved around one subject. You give the reader the impression that this entire, for example, cast is in the room giving their thoughts on one topic.
I think you could say that one of our attributes is an incredibly in-depth willingness to pursue something to almost a pedantic end. And I think that, you know, sometimes that could be in the level of detail of marginalia in the early issues, where we'll, you know, pull out some, you know, the can of juice that one of the interviewers is reading, and you've got a little kind of footnote on what, where you can buy that. You know, it's almost a sort of arch neurosis at one level in terms of textual detail, or the fact that we would, to accompany a profile of Apollonia Poilan, of Poilan bread, that you would get a double page spread with just a loaf of bread in it. It's that very sort of prosaic specificity, a sort of deadpan humor. Well, we think it's funny, maybe nobody else does. And then I think that continues into the kind of candor of portraiture. And then, you know, if you look at the structure of the current issue, there's in the front section, you know, there's about eight or so pieces called the modern details, which are about things like the fact that people haven't been wearing underwired bras and are switching to sports bras to do their Zoom calls, or the fact that an apology needs expressed in specific ways, and the kind of bit of a philosophical meditation on that. It's about specificity and detail. And, you know, you might say that's just across the board, that we will take things to an extra level, whether it's the actual manufacture of the magazine, it's the planning and evolution of the editorial, or it's the kind of style of the expression of the journalism. But it's, you know, it's less and better, if you want to take a shopping analogy.
Yeah, I like that. I have one more question about The Gentlewoman. When we talked earlier, you said that it can be tricky to find the right individuals to interview or put in the spotlights for an issue. How do you find that balance between, you know, featuring who you want to and staying away from other associations that maybe don't match with The Gentlewoman?
Well, in the early days, it was about fulfilling a list of people that, you know, at the level and depth that we interview people, they're always a Trojan horse for their work. And I think if you interview people like, you know, Inez van Lamsweerd and Vivian Westwood and Robin and Björk and all those kinds of people, that, you know, the inclusion of those people are absolutely about their accomplishments and to some extent, you know, their appearance, but they're also about what they're not. Their statement of refusal against the difference, their difference from other celebrities that might have been chosen. So, you know, you start to build up a kind of profile of a sort of politicized independent woman that is the poster person for their respective fields. So that's the kind of initial gesture. And then more recently, as I said, it's about starting to introduce surprises into that formula who might not have been seen to represent. So that's the sort of second phase. The phase at the moment, of course, is trying to navigate the politics of the times And, you know, taking, not so much taking responsibility for, but observing the fact that we are still connected with those people that we chose 10 years ago, and they're still seen as part of our identity and our decision to not do certain things or not include certain things. So we're in their hands, because, you know, the fact that we did Phoebe Philo is seen to be, as our first cover star, is seen to be significant, or Adele at 3, or Beyonce at 7, or Saoirse Ronan at 15. And all of those people in their different fields, and all the rest of them, are brushing up against, you know, over the years, you know, the way that people are excavating people's histories at the moment. You know, the directors that they've worked with, other actors that they've worked with, past and present. So, you know, now it's a part of the kind of digital culture is to look back at, you know, Saoirse Ronan, who we did in 6 years ago, and look at people that she worked with 10 years before that. And somehow we've all to atone for that now, you know, and it makes you think a lot about what it is to be a woman in the public eye like that, because, you know, often they're having to speak for decisions they made at that time, you know, because of the actions of these bastards that they've been working with. And then, you know, it often filters back to us. So you put I mentioned this to say that you're putting, they're putting themselves in our hands for sure. How we represent them, what we speak about them, what fact checking we do about them, making sure that we represent them correctly, because the way that people talk to us about our profiles, and they go up into our library on our website on thegentlewoman.co.uk. So that's one side of the transaction. But more recently, I'm having to think about the other side of the transaction is whatever they do in their careers going forward, we are associated with. So to a large extent, we are putting ourselves in their hands and their publicist's hands, and whatever, you know, big director that they work with and what comes out about them, etc. So it's a very interesting and difficult time. So you have to do much more due diligence probably than we did before. You know, I mean, we always did read every clip that we could possibly lay our hands on, but it is precarious. And it makes you feel for these people. And I sort of think, you know, this isn't just about actresses and musicians and things, although that's the start of it, isn't it? It's the kind of public face of it. But it will be the case for everybody, I think, you know, because what industry, you know, doesn't have people that have abused their privilege one way or another. And it's about how you, for me, you know, if it was a girlfriend that I wanted friends with, you know, I'd be, the measure of them isn't whether they somehow brushed up against somebody unwittingly or whatever. It's about whether they're honest and not hypocritical, you know, and how they handle it. But God help them, honestly, because you can't win. And I'm interested, of course, I'm interested in the women that say, yeah, that wasn't a great decision, but I've tried to put it right and here I am. And that's the sort of person I would have dinner with, not somebody that sort of somehow tries to deny it or play themselves off as some pious person that's completely untouched by it.
So am I right in saying that you wouldn't shy away from featuring women who have negative associations stuck to them that are out of their control? You know, when you're talking about how careful a lot of women have to be and how incredibly watched they are by the public eye.
All I'm saying is I am interested in getting to the phase, and I'm sure we're not there yet, where people, I'm interested to see how people handle it, because, you know, loads of people that we admire are having to, you know, put behind them experiences that they've had. And I don't think it's a particularly honest way for us all to live our lives, is, you know, to sort of imply that it never happened. You know, surely part of this is learning the rules about what you do when that's happened to you, and how you, you know, you get cancelled and then you're back. And you know, when you're going to interview people for pieces of 3,000, 4,000 words, the really interesting stories that we want to read, aren't they, are of often older women who have been through the career meltdown and the divorce and the transition. And, you know, that's what makes an interesting story about somebody. And you know, are reading it for entertainment, sure. But aren't, you know, in these role models that we select to be in The Gentlewoman, you're looking for advice, aren't you? You're kind of like, how did she do it? And that's what I hear about The Gentlewoman is, you know, people say, okay, in my industry where there aren't that many women in the boardroom, you know, I've heard people on the radio say, and I read The Gentlewoman and, you know, sometimes I hear the stories of how they did it and that I kind of try and think of them as my precedent or my advisor or my kind of sort of invisible mentor. So all of it's meant to be about sensible advice, whether it's what we suggest you might wear of all the options that are out there to deal with certain situations, or it's little, you know, pieces of advice about how to go to a party you can't be bothered going to, or, you know, how to be a good friend or a good godmother, all things. And yeah, isn't it how to deal with the good and the bad of digital communications and the scrutiny that women are held are subjected to, and the standards we're all now held to, you know, and just make it a bit easier for each other, because that's the kind of conversations and the kind of advice and mentoring, I guess, that I solicit personally of the people that I really look up to. You know, when I'm going to a dinner in the industry and I see him sat next to somebody that's kind of, you know, got a lot of experience, of course those are the kind of questions that I ask them, you know, and how did you do that? And when that went wrong, what, you know, I'm much more interested in reading that than about somebody in their kind of like charity, you know, fine. But actually, I want to know how to get out of a corner.
I'm going to bridge this to a question about you. Bit of a cliche, but they're there for a reason. If you would have to sit down with the self that you were in your, let's say, early 20s, which piece of advice would you give her?
Well, first of all, I couldn't have imagined I would be here because I thought I was progressing towards a career in academia at that point. In my early 20s, I would have still, no, I hadn't started my PhD yet, but I was working in a national museum and I was going to be a curator. And I guess I was working towards becoming a specialist. And I now know that that would have made me very unhappy. Because I like doing things in conversation, actually really benefit from collaboration. I love being surrounded by people that can do things I can't do. Really, really just want to be around clever people. Don't necessarily want to preside as the sort of the authority over other people. I'm always asking questions, I want to learn things. So I don't want to be the cleverest person in the room. And I think that would have been deathly. It was complete accident that I stopped that, unfortunately. My brother died and I stopped doing my PhD and was invited to start at Show Studio, and that the fashion website owned by Nick Knight and Pete Saville. And that couldn't have been foreseen. And I was at the Women's Library at that point on a contract. I think I had maternity leave and all these other benefits, which I just dropped. And in exchange for the offer of 3 months work until Christmas, and then was there for 7 years later and learned to become a really happy generalist and be involved in lots of things with lots of people. And sure, I mean, I've got some skills that are specialisms of sort, but I'm not, you know, I'm not in meetings anymore with people that would say, well, as a post-structuralist or as a historian, you know, where you're putting your specialism in front of yourself and kind of claiming authority and power that way, I'm just judged on whether what I make is any good. And I get to do a lot of that. And I couldn't have seen that that was a better way to live my life for me at my early 20s. So thank God for that.
I like this answer. So essentially, you accidentally realized what the right way for you to work is.
Yeah, in hindsight, I realized that was the right way for it to work. Of course, you never know that at the time. But when I was at secondary school, so that would be from 1984 till 1990, you know, that was the process of Jobs for Life being dismantled and kind of freelance short-term contracts being brought in. So I was already predisposed to the idea that I might not go to one job and become the company director and get a carriage clock after 35 years of service. It was unlikely that that would be what my working trajectory would be. But I hadn't imagined myself traveling over so many genres. Yes, you might say there's a sort of organizational principle, but I started in museums, then became an editor at websites, then went into academia, then went backwards, as they say in our industry, into print from digital. Yes, photography and fashion and communications are kind of the top level connection between all of those things, but I probably am the best, not best example, but I'm a good example of somebody where the platform doesn't really matter. I'm, in current agencies, they say she's a storyteller or a content creator or something like that. But I have just been lucky enough to create exhibitions and make magazines and lecture and public speak and be involved in, programming, etc., where the thread is the content or the subject and the medium actually isn't the message.
I want to thank you for all these insights. And then we have one final question left, which we ask all our guests.
Mm-hmm.
If you could invite anyone to this podcast's next episode, who would it be? Anyone in the world?
Gosh, I didn't realize it was to this podcast.
Oh, it can be any podcast.
Well, I was going to say, people are so accessible at the moment, especially to podcasts, that you could pretty much ask anybody in the world to be part of this podcast and you'd probably get them to turn up and sit down because the questions are fascinating it's a great thing that you're doing. What I would be interested to are the women that I can't get anymore, and some of the people that we most revered and loved that we featured at the Gentlewoman are now dead. So actually, I think if I was able to capture the voice and have a few extra insights from the literary editor, Diana Athill, Rain Spencer, who we did at The Gentlewoman, Lady Diana's stepmother, Agnes Varda, who was the cover star of our 18th issue, who was an absolute dream to work with, and taught me a lot in a short period of time, just about, I don't know, how to be a woman, maybe. And Stella Tennant, obviously, who very sadly died at the end of last year. We don't seem to be a publication that's long enough in the tooth to be looking back and have very prominent subjects that we featured who would now be gone, but they do start to mount up. And I would love to have a few extra conversations with them, that's for sure.
Beautiful answers, Penny. Thank you so much for your time. It was really great to hear all your stories.
My pleasure.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning into the Talk Tank. See you next week or leave a message after the beep.